This is The Guardian.
Hello friends, it's Grace here. Now, as some of you might know, Dave Myers, better known as one of the Hairy Bikers and a friend of Comfort Eating Podcast, passed away this week. He had been living with cancer for a few years. I know I'm not the only one floored by this news, and I'm sending my condolences to his family, his friends, and of course to Si. I will always remember the day Dave Myers rang my front doorbell, walked into my lounge, and came to talk to me for the pod. I can see him right now, how dapper he looked that day and how starstruck we all were. He was there. And of course, the stories he told us. I wanted to reshare Dave's episode with you now, as he is so honest about his childhood and career and his friendship with Si. And I think this gives you a good idea of the extraordinary life he had. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dave Myers.
Just a warning, there is some strong language in this episode.
I'm Grace Dent, and this is Comfort Eating from The Guardian. A podcast where we pay homage to the lesser celebrated foods in life. Because even as a restaurant critic, I believe the food that matters most is often that snack you cobble together when you're curled up on the sofa. Each week, I ask my guest to lift the lid on what comfort foods have seen them through their lives. Because you can tell a lot about a person from what they eat behind closed doors.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, friends. New year, same old kitchen, same old me, hopefully same old you, because you have been absolutely brilliant listeners so far. Happy New Year to you all. You find me here preparing a fantastic snack. Yes, it's the last of the mince pies. It has to be the last of the mince pies. And I'm having them with a large scoop of brandy butter. God, I love brandy butter. Why can't we have that every day? I am not entirely sure what day of the week it is, but I am aware that I have a guest who knows a thing or two about comfort food, and he's coming over today. It is Hairy Biker, Dave Myers. The Hairy Bikers have been cooking on our screens for nearly 20 years, which is not bad considering they were initially just looking for an excuse to eat food, ride motorbikes, and in their words, chat bollocks. The pair's new cookbook, Everyday Winners, is out now. Being one half of the nation's best loved bromances, I'm guessing you, like me, probably feel like you know Dave a bit already. But never underestimate the power of comfort eating. It always reveals a little more about people than you might expect. He seems like the loveliest man, and I honestly can't wait to meet him.
I mean, I am just spreading butter on a pie, really. Spreading butter, spreading boozy butter on a pie.
Dave Myers, welcome to Comfort Eating.
Thanks very much, Grace. It's an honour to be here.
This is a momentous occasion
because you are my first Cumbrian. I am a Cumbrian.
Yes.
And you're my first Cumbrian on Comfort Eating.
Yeah, of course, but you come from the capital, whereas I was just from the deep south in Barrow and Furness. You know, Carlisle was somewhere we dreamed of aspiring to. She's got a castle and a cathedral and everything.
Very much the Manhattan of Cumbria, yes. Isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
You are the first person to be on Comfort Eating who actually cooks for a living. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to seeing what ultimate comfort food that you've brought to share with me today. What are you hiding at the moment? I've smelled wonderful smells. It feels like it's a complex snack.
It's not complex. It was born out of inventiveness, I think, from when I was 6 or 7 years old.
Okay.
And I've got to admit, I can say, hand on my heart, I've had it twice this week for a breakfast. And it's a bit... Anyway, shall we?
Yeah. Unveil the snack. I have no idea what is in here.
I wouldn't get too excited. I loved, when I was a kid, tin tomatoes. We always used to have tin tomatoes on toast. So it's tin tomatoes on toast with a couple of rashers of bacon, but I have a bit of Marmite on the toast too.
No.
What? It's lovely. Oh, it's God. I think I discovered...
Visually...
Yeah, it's not much.
It looks like something from a horror film because it's fleshy. There's the tin tomatoes are oozing and then there is a slight whiff of yeast about
Yeah, that's the Marmite, you see. But the thing is, the tin tomatoes, you get the juice in the bread. So really, you know you have a panzanella salad?
Yes.
Yeah, think of that when you eat it.
I was foolishly trying to eat that with just one hand.
No.
And I saw the error in that right away. Hang on, I'm getting it.
Excuse me. But it is, I've tried to be really honest with this, you know, because I work in the food world like you,
yeah.
Do, and yeah. We both had some of the most wonderful food in the world. But this is really what I find comforting.
Do you realise that all the time you're talking, I am just stuffing this into my face?
I know, I've suddenly realised if I'm eating, I can't talk.
It's actually delicious.
Yeah, but what you have to do with the tomatoes, and I did discover this as a young boy, if you put the tomatoes into the pan, just as there's too much juice. So I suddenly realised if I left them to cook for a while, and I used to do the cooking from when I was little, they would get thicker and more tasty, which, of course, it's reduction. But now, I must admit, I'm on a can of San Marzano tomatoes and not the super cheap ones that my mother used to have.
Does it have to be white bread?
No. I like a nice piece of sourdough, to be fair. But again, you know, we've once tasted with years, improved with style. Bit of wholemeal will do all right.
That isn't actually proper delicious snack. You've actually bucked the trend of some of the absolutely disgusting things I've eaten over the last few episodes.
Thank you. That's a great compliment.
Dave, I understand that you were somewhat of a surprise addition to your parents' lives.
Yes, I mean, my mum went to the doctor and it was thought she had an ovarian cyst.
Oh, bloody hell.
And he was called Dr. Morrison, this Scottish GP. And he said, Mrs. Myers, this is the biggest bloody ovarian cyst I've ever seen. You're pregnant. And I was, she was 41 and she'd never thought she couldn't have children.
I mean, that's it. You were classed as a very geriatric mother.
But not geriatric, it's my dad because... It was his second wife. He was quite a bit older than my mum. So my dad was 55. But he was brilliant. He was a brilliant dad because, of course, he had time for me and he could retire. And actually, he did a little bit of cooking. But yes, so I was a surprise to both of them, really. I mean, I think I was conceived. After the war, they started going on, like, holiday. And they went to Switzerland, which was a huge thing for the pair of them from Barrow.
You know?
And they flew in a Douglas Dakota. I've still got pictures of them. And they were going to do the grand tour of Italy the next year, but instead I popped up. So, you know, I always think there's something of the Swiss about me, really.
You've written about what your mum was like during your early childhood in Barrow and Furness. She sounds like a real vivacious character.
Yeah, she was a big lady. She was sort of, she wasn't big tall. She was quite small, 5'3", but quite broad.
Yeah.
The sort of lady that Alan Bennett describes as a lady with a leg at each corner. And that was my mum. And during the war, she worked as a crane driver in the shipyard.
Yeah.
And I think she got strafed one night. And that was it. She gave the crane driving up. Until, after the war, she went and worked up in the lakes in a hotel in Grasmere. And then she came back and she drove cranes till I was born, really. See, the ladies became crane drivers because it said they had a gentler touch.
Right.
So they kept the ladies on after the war.
Yeah.
And so the ladies were surprised, like, because they'd all had their kids and my mum, that was the first. So they used to knit me baby clothes in the cabs. And with pictures of the cranes on from the shipyard and Vickers Armstrong. So apparently I had these really cool jumpers when I was a kid.
That must have been amazing, though, to feel like your mother was the kind of person that could drive a crane.
Yeah, yeah. My dad was a papermaker, so obviously he was a sensitive one.
Yeah.
But it was in a mill. It was a factory.
I was looking at something you'd said about your mum cooking plate pie.
Yeah.
And, when I read that, I was so happy that somebody else knew what plate pie was, because it's something that my gran used to cook and I never, ever hear it mentioned. So just to explain for anyone listening, it's basically just a pie, but it is made in a plate. So you need almost half of the contents, don't you? It's quite a shallow pie.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
It's shallow and wide, so it looks generous.
Yeah. So I always think of, when I think of my grandmother, I think of her almost making it with just one hand because she just didn't eat. She didn't even have to think about it.
No. I think a lot of northern households, they always had it was a dinner plate, inevitably a thick one off the market.
Yes.
And it was chipped and obviously it'd been baked. So it was quite brown and unsavoury looking.
Yeah.
But most homes had one, and that was for your pie. The plate was buttered and then the pastry went on. And then it was basically savoury mince.
Yeah.
Just mince meat, maybe an onion, just cooked and then filled on the plate with a top on. But the beauty of it is, and Si used to have it as well over in Newcastle, but they call it a cut and come again pie. Because you take a slice, but you want more, you cut and come again.
I love that.
Yeah.
Cut and come again.
Yeah. And when you can't stop it, I used to be terrible because I was a fat child. There's no getting around it in polite terms. But greedy, really, and round. I used to get to a point where I'd had my designated portion of pie.
Yeah.
And then I just have a slither. Then the slither would grow.
Yeah.
And in the end, I get to the point of no return.
And then you just think, well, I'm in it now.
I'm in deep.
So things change very suddenly when you're 8 years old and your mum is diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
Your dad has to take early retirement from his job at the paper mill. So how do you and your dad adapt to that?
It was hard. It was very hard. We were in a 2 up, 2 down in Barrow. So the idea of stair lifts don't exist. And this is why I feel such a strong compassion for, I was a young carer by default. But when you're a kid, it just happens. You don't question it. You just are.
You just have to muck in, don't you?
Yeah. And I think, sadly, I don't think things have improved much these days. If anything, there was community then that helped.
Mm.
But on the food front, my dad, of course, he'd been in industry all his life. We used to have Tyne brand tin mince.
Yes.
Smash.
Mm.
And Farrow's Marifat peas in a can.
Do you know, I love a Marifat pea.
But I came home one time from school, I think about 3 years, this was a staple diet. And he's there in his slippers. And he said, I looked down at this mess and I said, what is it? And what he'd done is he'd mixed the three ingredients together. And he said, I've made a risotto. Even then I thought, that's not a risotto, Dad. Something's got to change. But by then I was doing the shopping for the house. So that gave me control because my dad was, because he was that much older.
So hang on, how old were you when you had to first set off down the shops with a...
12.
A list that you'd made yourself.
Yeah, 12, 13.
Bloody
so remember, it was when the big supermarket had opened. By then we moved to a council estate.
Yeah.
Because it was on the ground floor, where the wheelchairs and stuff.
Yeah.
That did make life easier. But remember, there was a superstore opened.
So you go down with your budget and try and get
a tenner. And I could buy what I wanted. I remember I came back with a pizza once. Nobody knew what a pizza was, but it really was the worst cardboard disc with not really quite good tin tomatoes and grated cheese on. And of course, my parents were just like, I'm not eating this.
So you must have started to cook for both of them.
Mm.
What was on the menu?
I mean, first time I cooked for my dad was when it was when we first realised she had multiple sclerosis. She must have been about, I was about 7 or 8, and my dad was on a night shift. And I heard a thump, and Mum had gone to bed in the afternoon. I was just playing downstairs, you know, in front of the telly, and I heard a thump, and Mum was on the bedroom floor, and she couldn't move. And we didn't know what was wrong with her. And I thought, she was very calm. And she said, no, it's all right. Well, your dad will be home at 10 o'clock. And I just thought, it was nothing for my dad's tea. So I remember I cooked him a cheese and potato pie. And I found the recipe in this cookbook that had come with the gas cooker. And they must have, the gas cooker must have bought that just after the war.
Yeah.
And I made this cheese and potato pie. And it was funny, I worked on a thing and I went back home. And they found that cookbook, and I did actually cook that pie again.
So were there times when you and your dad ever got out of the house together?
Yeah, well, before my mum got really, really ill, yeah, he always had a motorbike. He was one of those northern chaps who a motorcycle was a mode of transport. The thought of it never crossed his mind he'd own a car. So he always had the motorbike. And as I said, because he was older and he retired early, it was great. He was the best dad. I always say, like, some of my mates are having children late in life and they have a huge crisis of confidence. And I'm going, do it. It's brilliant. Because my dad was better than anybody else's.
Yeah.
But when he was 65, I was still on the back of the motorbike. He was taking me fishing and shooting. And well, not shooting. I'm not talking like the posh people. I'm talking about trying to, you know, nail a rabbit in a field.
So, you were always really a carer, and going into your teenage years, you've never really been carefree. You've always been caring for someone. Did that affect the kind of teenager you became?
Yes, yeah. I had alopecia as well, which is quite ironic, seeing as known as a hairy biker. I had no hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes. Started when I was 8, funnily enough. And I was, you know, kind of, it was really, really bald. You know, it starts off with alopecia areata, so it's kind of...
Where did it start? On your hair?
Oh,
on
your, yeah, it's on here, there and everywhere. So it's not like you're going bald. And that was the time before it was cool to be bald. And I think my only role model was Yul Brynner in The King and I. I think that the more ill somebody gets, the more, the harder it is to look after them, the more work it takes.
So, and it was both of your parents that were very
ill.
Yeah,
well, what happened was I came home from school one day and my dad had a stroke.
And, where was he, in the living room? Or?
Yeah, he was just in a chair and he was just like over on one side. And my mum was sitting there because obviously nobody could take her to the loo. So again, I walked into chaos. I was in the sixth form at school. I've always been quite good at school and I've done quite well. And I just walked into chaos. And after about a week, I was looking after both of them. It was a district nurse came for the regular visit. I did phone a doctor. And the doctor told me to give my father aspirins and put him to bed. That was it. And I was on my own for a week. I didn't go into school because obviously I couldn't. And then the social services came and they said, "There's one of your parents can go into hospital. Which one do you feel you can better look after?" And I knew my mum wouldn't get better. And I knew my dad would. So I thought, my mum, really. And she didn't get, well, she went into hospital and never came out. And she lived there for almost 5 years, you know. Hard decision, really, for a 17-year-old to make.
An impossible decision.
Yeah, yeah. My dad did get better, so he was functioning and, you know, he understood. But actually, you know, when you think back, it was his wife, you know. And to me, I was just surviving and trying to do what I could. It was hard.
Was there anything at all that gave you happiness?
Oh, my
that
mates.
Point?
Mates, I had some great friends at school. Funny enough, the kids the year above me, through the art department, it was always, we had this amazing art teacher called Mr. Eaton, and he was very flamboyant. It was a northern boy's grammar, and he was the one with the red midget sports car, the matching ties and everything, and he could draw, it was amazing. And there was kind of like a chap called Graham who was older than me, a year older, and he went off to Goldsmiths to do art. I followed in his wake to Goldsmiths. And there was a third member, actually, who went to Goldsmiths, all Mr. Eaton's boys. But within that, they were always, you know what it's like in the north, like the pub culture and everything, yes. in a working class town.
Yeah.
So, you know, they would take me for a pint.
But you needed a pint. I mean,
I had friends like that.
Yeah.
And actually, they were always really, really supportive. And so that was it, really.
What did you eat together?
Well, we still, there's a friend of mine, Pete, who actually became a director of British Telecom. So we kind of did all right, us northern lads. But Pete, we used to cook these. It was, there's always been a Chinese food culture in Barrow, you know, the Chinese takeaways. And some of them are pretty good. You know, it wasn't all kind of terrible food and packed with onions and monosodium glutamate. And it was, I think it was £1.30 for a takeaway with your fried rice. So Pete and I used to do our curries. So when we come back from the pub, which could have been everything, like a bag of rice, we used to make them with tuna fish or sausages.
No, hang on a minute. There is no such thing as tuna fish curry.
There really isn't in our house. I suppose it was like, but then it was curry powder.
Yeah.
So yeah. I suppose the French would call it, you know.
They call it well, the French have a really fancy word for curry powder, isn't it? Like va-de-vin or something. Va-de-vin.
Au curry.
Yeah.
You know. So this should be
au curry.
Tonneau au riz au curry.
Let me see. It sounds a lot more delicious now.
Yeah, but we used to charge them 30 pence for it. So it was a winner, wasn't it? We had more money to spend on beer.
Right. Hang on. Wind back. You were selling homemade tuna fish curry to who? To people that were...
Well, our mates, you see, because we used to £1.30 for a takeaway. So this was a bargain at 30 pence. Now, in those days, we're talking about 4 pints to the pound.
Yeah.
So really, it's a win-win. So you got an extra 4 pints, and plus you got your carbohydrate at the end of the evening.
Hang on, were they coming to your house and eating it?
Yeah, they could come to my house, you see, because my parents weren't functioning. So this, you know, you talk about the best of adversity. So somebody kept the noise down. They were out the way.
This is it. Every cloud has a silver lining. Has a silver tuna curry flavoured lining.
Yeah, and funny enough, now Pete and I are in our 60s. We did meet up to repeat the experience. But the thing is, because he's been a keen cook and obviously what I do for a living, we really couldn't capture that authentic naivety of what we used to serve up to our mates, you know. It was just a bit too fancy, really.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So you've got all this responsibility and horrible things that have happened, but you're still really looking ahead to the future, and you still apply to study fine art at one of the most prestigious places in the country. You go to Goldsmiths, University of London. What did you actually know about London when
I used to, I say my world was, my friends, it was Graham, who was the most amazing painter. And I say, he's still, you know, he's actually made a living out of his brushes. So I kind of followed in Graham's wake. But I remember the first time I came, so I used to smoke a pipe with tobacco. And so I'd just sit there thinking I was a Pre-Raphaelite. You know, we're obsessed with the Pre-Raphaelites, Holman, Hunt and Rossetti.
Yeah.
And there was three of us. We used to go to the Walker and look at the exhibitions. So obviously the pipe came with it. So when I was painting, I thought this is going to make it better, you know. So anyway, I turned up in London for my interview. I had my portfolio over my arm, which is kind of homemade, you know, with like some kind of strappage over my shoulder. And I can remember I had this red denim jacket, green corduroy trousers, a pair of red kickers.
Hang on a minute.
And a scarf.
It's red and you've got green corduroy trousers. This is quite the outfit.
And so I went to Goldsmiths, got out at New Cross, had my interview. So I got a place. I think it was something like 3,000 applied. And I was in the intake.
It feels like you weren't intimidated.
No, ignorance. It's happened twice in my life, actually, that I've been completely ignorant of circumstance. Yeah. And it's helped.
Yeah, you didn't really know what you were walking into.
No,
to realise it was a massive deal.
No, I just wanted to be my mate Graham in London. It sounded great because, you see, a Goldsmiths, it was the freest art school in the country.
Yes.
So, you know, ultimately you could do what you wanted.
But you've gone from being a carer and, I mean, and I've done caring as well, and I know that your time is so regimented. The days actually fly by pretty quickly because everything needs to be done at certain times.
Yes.
And you've got so much responsibility and then you're at Goldsmiths and you're free.
Yes. The grant was actually pretty decent.
Yeah.
And I was working in the summers in the steelworks in Barrow. So I was okay. But the it was good. I was very nervous. I still had no hair then, which we found quite intimidating, really.
So did you look like a skinhead at this point? I mean, did you shave it all off?
I shaved off what I had left, No, I looked like a big embryo, Grace. I had no eyebrows and eyelashes. I wasn't going to pull. do you know what I mean? It's like my mate Graham, the one I'd followed in his wake, was devastatingly handsome.
Was he really handsome?
Yeah, he still is, God love him. But no, at that point, I was like his mate, you know. And we shared a flat in Peckham, 56 Asylum Road. It was £9 a week each. We shared a room. And there we set up to paint.
And did you cook together?
Yeah, we did. There was a Turkish cafe down the road that we discovered. And that was epic. You know, like spaghetti bolognese that really was made from meat and it had some degree of herbs and spicing. Yes. I just thought, this was a game changer. Yeah. So really the grant didn't last long. So I kind of, and then of course the Chinese food, I'd go to Soho. Yeah. And so that's when I started really cooking because I could buy the ingredients at the supermarkets in Soho. I could bring them back. And so I did finish the first term, absolutely the £200 overdraft, and I bought about 2 stone.
So what was it like? You've had this amazing time in London and then you have to go back to Barrow and you work in the steelyard. That must be a huge change again.
It was. It was good, though. Again, the camaraderie. My uncle was the foreman there, my uncle Harry. And so I was in the building department. And I loved it. I actually loved it. The people were brilliant.
Did you turn up in the tartan trousers with the pipe, though?
No, I turned up in my bar. I tell you what I did do, though. I turned up in Dr. Martin boots. And this was still the and I'm there, you know, me oxblood Doc Martens, and I had my overall, let me give you a boiler suit. And then what did they do? They put me on a cradle. You shut the furnaces, that big electric arc furnace, maybe about 10, 15 metres across, and they lift the lid off. Well, obviously, all the hot metal and the bricks inside, it's roasting, to say the least.
Yeah.
So there's two of you go down in a cradle, and you have to, my job was to hold the big chisel while it was Big Brian, it was called, hit that chisel and you cut the steel hawsers, but you're on a metal plate.
That sounds scary.
It was, but the men there were so caring. You know, all I can say is, in terms of community, they were brilliant blokes, except, of course, I had Dr. Martens on. And why wasn't I wearing clogs? I thought this is too much a northern cliche to wear clogs for work. I thought, come on, since then.
I thought that was a cliche. I didn't actually think that the clogs were.
Yeah, they do. They keep your feet going. My Dr. Martens caught fire. Well, they just melted the soles. So that was it. So when they finished laughing at me, they were like kind of gumdrops on my feet. And, you know, you take your packed lunches and stuff. And there was a stove there. Not there was much cooking going on.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rice pudding straight from the tin.
You can't beat it.
No, it's all right. There was a case of bullying. There was one fight there once, and I did see somebody get hit with a tin of rice pudding as a weapon, kind of ambrosia in the mush. But no, it was nice, and Steelworks breakfasts were really inspiring, you know. Because I came back from art school being lardy and full of curry.
Yeah.
All manner of things.
What's the Steelworks breakfast?
You know, like the black puddings you see in the butcher's windows that are the rings?
Yes.
Yeah, a whole one of those.
Yeah.
A whole thing of Cumberland sausage, a couple of eggs, tin tomatoes. And then, you know, it's just everything and loads of toast. And, of course, you're working. And again, in the steelworks, you always got access to cold milk for some reason. But there's nothing tasty better. Just a pint of... I would never drink milk now like that, but a pint of ice-cold milk or a quart of ice-cold milk. But I think for me, it was belonging. Yes. And after what I've been through, you know, it was belonging. And there's some extent of care, even if it's a bit rough and ready, they're still looking after you. And, you know, even if I was doing a horrible job, there'd be somebody there keeping an eye out for me. A lot of those traditions were very valid and gave people a decent quality of life.
One of the facts I love about you is that you worked as a makeup artist for many years. And I often wonder how this motorbike loving turnstile worker in the early 80s that you end up painting faces at the BBC. So could you do my makeup? That's what I'm...
Oh, God, yes.
Like, you could.
Yeah, I used to.
Interesting.
Well, 23 years, Grace, yeah.
There you go.
I mean, I got nominated for 2 RTS awards as a makeup artist and 2 RTS awards as a turn on the telly. But no, I was...
I love it.
I was working as a car park attendant as an advert for trainee makeup artists. And again, there was thousands applied and they took 10 of us on. And they were looking for people with fine art degrees. It's the time that they'd done like I Claudius with Derek Jacobi, and the artistic side was becoming more and more important. But I didn't realise he had to do hair as well. At the time, I was living with a French au pair in Blackheath. I applied for 2 jobs. One was a trainee picture frame restorer at the National Gallery, and one was the trainee makeup artist at the Beeb. And I remember before the interview, the French au pair was sharing the flat with, I got her to tip a handbag on the table and go through what the bits and pieces were. Because he said you'd have to do a straight makeup, an ageing makeup, and then a piece of hair work. I don't know. Again,
yeah.
I was saying before, I had no idea what was expected. So I turned up at Television Centre with the contents of a handbag in my head of being from the steel. And one of my references, by the way, was from British Steel Corporation.
But how did you even begin? Because makeup is difficult. So how? No, what?
Right. So they said you just need to do a street makeup, and they had a grease base, a liquid base, and a pancake base.
Okay.
Well, you see, obviously, you use a liquid base.
Yeah.
But you see, I don't ever see my mother with use the compact. Yeah. You know, the Max Factor.
Yes.
The cream puff.
Yes.
So I thought, and it looked to me looked like a cake of powder paint.
Yeah.
So I started with a pancake, which is notoriously difficult to get level.
Yeah.
But I had a certain facility. And I can remember they were 2 of the senior makeup artists, a lady called Pam Meager and Cherry Alston, very exalted. So they were there with a notepad. So I'm very interested to use the pancake base. Why? I said, oh, it just seemed appropriate. Very good. I was like, and I got through that. Then I had my interview and I got the job. Yeah, because I'd only ever seen the films you see, like the Munsters and the Addams Family, where it was all the Westmores and these great Hollywood dynasties of men. But what I didn't realise is spinning this is I was the first male makeup artist at Television Centre.
Yeah.
And I just applied myself and got through it.
So you're a makeup artist and then you cross paths with the man who would become your fellow hairy biker, Cy King. Tell me about the first time you ever set eyes on
him. Well, I applied for a job on the Catherine Cookson dramas. Do you remember those ones in the Northeast?
Yeah.
And it's called The Gambling Man with Robson Green. And
I used to love these Catherine Cookson dramas.
And the production values are fantastic.
Yeah.
I did about 7 of them over nearly 2 or 3 years up there. And I remember I got the job. So they took me down to meet the crew and they're in a pub called the Egypt Cottage. It's next door to what was old Time Tees Television. It's a car park now. And I walked in there and the crew are there, some being indifferent, you know, the media, and they've got the white wine spritzers and the, you know, sandwich. And then Cy is only in his 20s then, standing by the pool table, looking like some mad Viking. He's going, Julian, what have you got? He said, it's a chicken curry today. I'll have that. It's in a pint of lager. So anyway, well, I'll have what he's having then. And we got talking over the curry. And he was the second assistant director. That's the one who's responsible for all the calls. And so Cy and I did the work that afternoon. And we just got on like a house on fire. We both come from kind of like almost single parent backgrounds. Mm. One thing, you know, that we both love motorbikes.
Yeah.
And we both love food.
Yeah.
And we both loved eating.
Yeah.
And I went round to his house for Sunday lunch. He had two young children. I remember he cooked the most wonderful roast lamb and all the trimmings. And he sold me a motorbike. that was terrible. He absolutely ripped me off. And that's how it started, really. He came, I was living in the Highlands, and he came up to the Highlands to take the motorbike back. But then we were just really, really good friends, and Si would come up, you know, whenever he'd finished work, and Si had the idea, why don't we just try and make our own programmes?
But hundreds of people that work in telly probably have dreams that they will get in front of the camera and that they'll maybe get a pilot up and running.
Yes.
But you did it.
We did it, yeah. We wrote this treatment together called... I think the secret was somebody said, you know, if you're going to write a book, write it on what you know.
Yes.
And we sat in a pub, we knew about food, we knew about eating, cooking, riding motorbikes and talking bollocks. So we wrote it up in this treatment called Motorcycles, Food and the Search for Nirvana. Not exactly snappy.
I would watch that, though.
There were six producers we sent it to that we'd worked with, that we liked. And it just shows you must send that letter if you've got an inkling.
And, I mean... 20 years of Hairy Bikers programmes later.
Nearly.
The impression I get is that you are actually genuinely friends.
Oh, we are. We've been through a lot together, you know, over the years, bereavements, tragedies, you know, the whole lot, you know, divorces and not to each other, but you know what I mean? We've been through a lot of the harsh stuff as well. He had a brain hemorrhage in 2013 and he was proper poorly. Yeah, that was a shock, really. It's funny because it was in 2012, 2013. He wanted to take time off work and I didn't because I've still got that. I'm from Barrow, you know, you don't turn work down, mate. You don't know when it's flowing. He said, no, I want to go on with the boys. That's when I did Strictly, which I absolutely adored. But we're due to go back to work and because he had a brain hemorrhage, so we ended up having like a year off. He was okay, caught it in time. But even then, the morning it happened, we'd been out. We were on a book tour and he kept saying, it's a funny headache, you know. And I was saying, well, so have I. You know, if you spend so many hours in Costco signing books, you do get a bit. And that morning, because I'd stayed over at Si's, and we got the fish key because I bought a load of fish to take home. He bought fish for the weekend. And we were sitting there in the fish key eating bacon sandwiches and tea. And it was that day he went home and he said he was watching the rugby and the players slid off the screen. And next thing I knew, he was in intensive care in Newcastle. So I went up there.
You went there?
Yeah, and the people told me that he'd be all right. He was stable. They put a stent in. But he was quite funny. He was obviously in the land that time forgot, really. And the nurses were great. And he was, you know, it was okay.
Did you take him any gifts?
Well, no, he said, Dave. And this is his hand, you know. I thought, oh, he's going to get sentimental now. And he said, you couldn't nip down to Marx's and get us a pork pie. He said, I'm starving. So I'm not lying. I went down to Marks and Spencer's and I'm breaking bits of pork pie. He wasn't on a ventilator, but he's like trying to discreetly eat this pork pie while I was in intensive care.
That's friendship.
We never get bored with cooking and we never get bored with the food world. When we find ourselves at a food festival and we're sharing the bill with Gordon Ramsay or Michel Roux Jr., you know, we're in awe of these people's talent. Yeah. Our talent's different, but it's a real buzz.
You've done countless cookery programmes together. How does cooking on set compare with cooking at home?
The big difference is, I don't know, it's probably a bad analogy, really. When you cook on the telly, it must be a bit like making pornography. Because, do you know what I mean? It gets you going. It's all there, but it doesn't deliver. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like at home,
yeah.
You see, we learn so much on a series. I mean, you know, we just had our 25th book out. And so, obviously, all the research and we haven't got a restaurant because we spend all the time working and playing with food and eating. So, and when we're filming, you've got these recipes and you know that a family at home would love them. And so I do cook at home and I like to show off and I cook all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I love it. And that's the difference is that you get to share the food with the people you love. And, you know, even Si and I will... You know, like my birthday or something, if my wife said, we'll get together and cook.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. We have a boys' night, yeah.
So we've just welcomed in the new year, and I'm very curious, what's a Hairy Biker's approach to New Year's resolutions?
I think the older you get, the more conscious we are of staying healthy and alive. You know, we're having such a good ride in life that we want to keep on doing it. And I think the resolution is really to... You know, just look after each, well, Si and I look after each other, and I think for me, to look after myself more, really, you know, to make sure that I've got another couple of decades of riding my bike and cooking, eating and talking bollocks, really, Grace.
20 more years at least of hairy bikers.
Yeah, but the hairy Zimmers by then.
The hairy Zimmers.
Yeah, it'd be all right. Won't be much hair, that's slipping back and all.
I'll buy that book.
Yes, processed food, everything in a blender.
Dave Myers, thank you so much for coming.
Oh, you're more than welcome, Grace. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This episode of Comfort Eating was produced by Jack Claremont and Emma Roberts. The series producer is Leia Green, and the executive producer is Kathy Drysdale. The music was written by Axel Cacoutier. Mixing and sound design was by Sammy L. Anani. If you like Comfort Eating, please leave us a review. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And use the hashtag ComfortEatingPod to get in touch about the podcast or share your own comfort foods.
This is The Guardian.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.